Twisted Sisters Crime will contain mature content, graphic descriptions, and violence.
Listener discretion is advised. This podcast may upset trauma survivors.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Happy podcast day, and may you always steer clear of psychos. Now, before we begin, we have a very special stat report brought to you all the way from Neighborhood Scout.
Did you just quote the Hunger Games to start off our Colorado episode?
Sure did.
Whatever. This rectangle state had 21,938 violent crimes in 2019. Their rate was at 3.81, or 1 in 263 residents. There were 218 murders, 3,872 rapes, 3,663 robberies, and 14,185 assaults.
Well, the odds were not in their favor, pesky criminals. Did you know that in Pueblo, Colorado, you are not legally allowed to have weeds or dandelions on your property that are taller than 10 inches? It's also illegal in Logan County to kiss a sleeping woman.
I mean, those seem reasonable. They just have nice yards and possibly less sexual assaults.
And with that, hopefully everyone stayed safe this week. And so without further ado, let's hear our first story from Christ L.
Mm. That's me. My story this week is Paige Bergfeld, a loving mother who led a double life.
Ooh, yes, queen, go.
Yes. On June 28, 2007, Paige was reported missing, which was extremely odd. Why would she leave behind her three gorgeous children that she had absolutely loved? The original story was that was kind of like pushed on detectives that they investigated was that she kind of simply grew like weary of her life and decided to kind of just abandon her job and her children. However, it did not take long for detectives to dismiss this original story. By all accounts, this woman absolutely like adored her children and would never willingly leave them. When Paige's father was asked about the likelihood of his daughter abandoning her children, he said that if Paige had broken like her legs, she would crawl on her elbows to get to her kids.
Oh, that's so like,
I know.
Sweet.
So sweet. So as detectives kind of dug in, the focus of this investigation kind of centered on the men in Paige's life. That kind of includes her two ex-husbands. According to those close to Paige, she had recently begun seeing her first ex-husband. The two had been high school sweethearts and had a relationship that lasted more than 10 years. Ron rose to the surface kind of as a person of interest. The two had a date on the day that Paige went missing.
Oh no.
Ron had also followed up several times when she failed to answer his phone calls. So shortly before her disappearance, the two kind of started dating again. In fact, they had met at a rest stop kind of halfway in between the two cities of theirs on the day that she did disappear. Paige had called him on her way back from their encounter at around 9 p.m. She was kind of just a few miles from home. The Bergfelds kind of started their own investigation, not believing that Ron was the most likely suspect. Police kind of kept an eye on the family doing this investigation, but continued like interviewing people who had spent time with or contacted Paige kind of within the hours of her death. Despite being a person of interest, those who knew the two of them found it hard to believe that Ron would harm her in any way. Those close to Paige believed that it would be a good idea for investigators to focus their efforts on the second ex-husband, Rob.
She's Rob and Ron.
Rob, Ron, I know. Okay, so Rob had a very strong connection to Paige. He was the father of their three children. According to witnesses, the two kind of had a very volatile relationship. So the plot kind of thickens. The police turned to ex-husband number two for answers. Rob had been a successful businessman when he'd married Paige, but it didn't take long for his investments to fail. So Paige had to pick up the slack by running a preschool dance company and became a top salesperson for Pampered Chef.
Okay, but they have really cool stuff, so.
They do. They really do.
They really so. Do.
But Rob kind of spent money faster than Paige could bring it in. So by 2006, Paige had called the police twice because of Rob's threatening behavior. Although police thought he may have killed Paige, like the first ex-husband, he kind of had a solid alibi.
Oh, no. Mm-hmm.
So on July 1st of 2007, Paige's Ford Focus was found burning in an empty parking lot. She was missing for like a week, and her car's found burning. Investigators were certain that the car had been torched in order to destroy the evidence.
Well, yeah, for sure.
Obviously. The same car that she was driving the night that she never came home. A few things that kind of stood out to detectives was that the driver's seat was all the way back. So even though Paige had just been 5'4" tall about.
So someone really tall.
Someone really tall had driven her car, yes. Second, her planner was found in the trunk with the last four pages ripped out.
Ooh.
So clearly the person who did this did not want their identity being revealed, knowing that they were probably meeting up after this.
Yeah, clearly someone that she was planning on meeting, so hopefully someone else knows.
Hopefully. However, her body was not inside the car. Police also found some of Paige's belongings, including some business cards and letterhead for a company called Models Inc., scattered kind of around where her car was burned, also along a mile of highway, kind of near Grand Junction, Colorado. So with these kind of business cards, the police realized that Paige probably had this secret life that nobody knew about. Although her last call had been to Ron, her first ex-husband, she also received several calls that night from other people. As it turns out, they were all clients of this Models Inc. It is a secret escort business that Paige ran on the DL.
Wow! Paige!
Not only did this hardworking mother of three children teach dance and sell kitchenware, she was also working as a high-priced paid escort.
I mean, women can multitask.
Women are.
She is clearly
superwoman.
A boss. Beep, beep, babe.
Beep! That's when certain extraneous details about Paige's background started coming together to kind of paint a different picture. Paige had had a long love of dance, which she eventually did turn into a business teaching children. However, this same passion also expressed itself in different ways when Paige became an exotic dancer shortly after she married her first husband. When Paige's second husband left for Philadelphia, Paige was desperate to kind of remain a super mom and equally desperate to maintain her very high lifestyle. So she drew on the dance background and kind of came upon this Models Inc., which she ran from a separate office as well as from her home. Paige's business took off really quickly with so much demand that at times she kind of changed her voice on the phone so that clients thought she had like bigger clients that she, you know, than she actually was employed by. More and more men were seeking Paige out by using her fake name, which was Carrie.
Like Carrie Underwood, Carrie pig's blood all over her.
That's what I think of when I hear Carrie, but yeah. Paige drew the line at having sex with any of her firm's clients. But she did pick up occasional cash by doing private dances. By reconstructing the phone calls, police found many of the clients of Models Inc. So that created a lot of extra work since they had to find and investigate each one.
Oh no.
Like, I couldn't imagine how many dudes they called up.
They're like, hi, Carrie. And they're like, actually, this is the Colorado PD. And they're like, oh, frick.
Oh no.
Wrong number.
So someone left Paige a message on the night of her disappearance stating, quote, this is John at Motel 6. Just wondering if you're coming out or not, end quote. One man had paid over $14,000 for encounters with escorts, most of which had been kind of by fraudulent checks.
Guys.
A cocaine addict named George called Paige 20 times on the night that she never came home, but he drowned in 2011.
Ugh.
Although these were all attractive suspects, none of them panned out at all. Then police found this guy named, quote, Jim.
Oh.
Who had placed two calls to Paige on the night that she went missing. This Jim guy placed the calls from a local Walmart store where he had gone to purchase a track phone. The Walmart surveillance tape ultimately gave the police like a first look at Paige's killer. So tracking him down, they found out his name was Lester Jones.
Lester Jones is Jim?
Is Jim.
Oh, thank goodness it's not Jim Halpert.
Oh, goodness. Lester Jones was one of Paige's escort clients, and he kind of had developed a fixation with her. Lester had been convicted of kidnapping and assaulting his ex-wife. Officers picked him up for questioning, quickly realizing that Jones's second wife had been out of town of the night of Paige's disappearance. Lester didn't seem to have an alibi, admitting that he had left his house between 9 and 10 p.m., exactly when Paige received her last phone calls. Jones was 6 foot 5 inches tall, which made him exactly the right height to have been behind the wheel of her red Ford Focus. Jones had also been working at an RV store that was conveniently located right across from the parking lot where they had found her car burning.
Okay, this is weird because
adding all up.
Like 2 weeks ago, I was driving to work and on the east side of the freeway at Riverdale, like right across the RV lot at that used car dealership, was a bunch of cars on fire.
Oh, cool.
Lester, get out of my hood. This isn't
Lester.
Fun.
Lester. Not tea. When the police searched Jones' workplace, they had found incriminating evidence like handwritten notes about escorts, the kind of sex that they would agree to, wigs, and Viagra pills. Despite this evidence, there was no direct evidence linking him to Paige's disappearance. As Paige's father remembers, the only reason Jones was not arrested was because there was still no sign of the body. Despite all of the suspicion surrounding him, it was not until 2012 that things would kind of heat up again. So a group of hikers found human remains, a piece of a human skull, on a hike about 60 miles south of Paige's home. There was duct tape around the jawline to the back of the head.
Mm.
More bones were quickly found across a kind of a mile stretch of the dry creek bed. Medical examiners were able to identify the remains as being Paige's by using the dental records. Because of the fact that there was no like remaining flesh, the medical examiner was not able to determine the cause of death. However, severe damage was made to the cheekbone, made it kind of clear that she had been beaten at some point. It took all the way to 2014, but Lester Jones was finally arrested and charged with intentional death of Paige. In September of 2016, Lester went on trial for murdering Paige. However, the jury came back hung, kind of a 6-3. Prosecutors felt that the jury was kind of put off by Paige's double life, but they kind of didn't, like, push that aside either.
Okay, guys, it's 2016. Get over it.
Right.
Oh, my gosh.
So it wasn't really until Jones's first wife came forward with tales about times that he would beat her, threaten the lives of all of her boyfriends after her, or, like, after their marriage. She did suspect that Lester had killed Paige because he'd feared that his second wife was about to find out that he was paying for sex. During the second trial, Jones had difficulties kind of sorting through his lies. So District Attorney Rubenstein told Crime Watch Daily, quote, "First, he denied being at Walmart at all. Then he was there to buy a soda. Ultimately, when shown the picture, he said he was there buying a monster cable," end quote. So yeah, he didn't know, like, what he was saying, like...
Bro, you don't go all the way to Walmart to buy a soda. You go to the McDonald's and get one for $1. Or the Maverick. Gas station, yeah. You don't drive all the way to Walmart and be like, "All right, thanks for the soda. I'm out now, Nimnard."
Moreover, like, police dogs had tracked Jones's scent to her car. Lester's defense lawyers decided to pursue kind of a strategy that would pin the crime on the man who drowned back in 2011. But despite his lawyers' efforts, he did go into a completely different direction. Stunningly, he did admit to killing Paige. Lester never explained his motives, but finally in November of 2016, nearly a full 10 years after her disappearance, Lester was convicted of her murder, and he was given a 65-year sentence.
Yes!
Now Paige's children must pick up the pieces left behind of their mother's murder. Her oldest child was just 8 when she died. Her daughter graduated high school by the time that Jones was convicted. They lived with their grandparents, and the children have a closer bond with their father, but they say they will never forget the mother who would do anything to support them.
So Barbara Bobby Joe was 24 when she married Jeff Oberholzer on July 1st of 1977. January 7th of 1982, Jeff was described in complete rage when he found her dead body dumped near a scenic overlook just 5 miles south of Breckenridge, Colorado. They had resided in Alma, which was about 14 miles away. Until this point, they were happily married. Him running an appliance repair business and Bobby working as a receptionist at Breckenridge. According to Jeff, the day started as normal as any other day. She left at 7:15 a.m. preparing to hitchhike to work. Now again, while hitchhiking now seems like a death wish, in this small community back in the early 80s, it was super safe and a lot of people did it. In fact, a lot of people did it in the whole country because no one understood yet that cycles are out there. But it's okay. We forgive them. So at 6:20 p.m., she did call Jeff and tell him that she was out with her friends. He asked if she wanted him to come pick her up, but she told him to not worry and that she would find a ride home. At 7:50 p.m., she left the Village Pub, an old bar at the Bell Tower Mall, leaving her friends and planning to hitchhike home. This was the last time that anyone saw her. While Jeff waited, he made his wife some dinner and then accidentally fell asleep waiting. He woke up around midnight, found Bobby was still gone. Worried but not wanting to overreact, he waited until a little after 2 a.m. when he knew that all the bars would be closed. When Bobby still was not home, he started to go out looking. He learned from her friends that she had left around 7:50, and when he did try to go to police and report her missing, he was told it was too early for him to do anything, so he went home and tried to wait some more. Like, why can't we just... say that people are missing when they're missing?
Right.
Like, I know that there would be, like, a lot of more cases, but people know they're people that they're trying to report missing.
Mm-hmm.
Drives me crazy sometimes. So that morning, A farmer who lived 30 miles outside of Breckenridge found Bobby's license, so Jeff and his two friends drove to pick it up. While on the way there, they spotted something blue in the white snow-covered field. They got closer, and Jeff noticed that it was Bobby's backpack, which she always had with her. Inside was a blood-spattered glove and some bloody tissues. In a panic, Jeff and his friends started looking around for her. Two panic-filled hours later, they found her body 15 miles from where her backpack was.
Oh my god.
Like, her husband found her.
That's insane!
Oh, I couldn't imagine.
Heck no.
They found her with a plastic cord tied around one of her wrists and only her footprints at the scene. Bobby was shot twice in her chest and showed no signs of sexual assault, thankfully. Forensic evidence led officers to believe she was shot at the scene where her body was found. Her Huskies were found at the scene and also one orange sock. However, this sock was not hers.
Well, I wouldn't think that the blood-spattered glove and some bloody tissue were hers either.
Well, we're going to get to that because apparently somebody did. And that led to a long wait because people are stupid. So now we have Annette Schnee, who was a cocktail waitress from Frisco, Colorado. On January 6th of 1982, she left her first job at the Holiday Inn feeling sick. Reportedly, she went to some medical center in Frisco, then got a ride to Breckenridge to the pharmacy on Ski Hill Road. She was seen here at 4:45 with another woman who police believe she knew, said she talked to for a long time, and witnesses even recall Annette telling her not to forget to buy her cigarettes. This was the last time that Annette was seen, as she did not show up for her 8 p.m. shift at the Flipside Bar at Beaver Run. Unfortunately for Annette and her family, it took 6 months for them to find her body. July 3rd of 1982, a father and a son on a fishing trip found her body face down in Sacramento Creek, about 20 miles south of Breckenridge. She had a single gunshot wound in her back that was apparently shot at the location. She was fully clothed, but her clothes were all in disarray. One orange sock on her left foot, but boots on both of her feet.
Hmm.
So, I don't know about you, but I'm not gonna put my boots on with only one sock. So they think that she got assaulted. And, yeah. The cold water that she was found in allowed them to perform an autopsy on Annette, however they could not test her for signs of sexual assault. It was discovered that both girls had gone missing on January 6th and both had been shot with a 38mm handgun using a Remington Peters copper jacketed hollow point bullet. Whatever that means. With a gun. The police believed that they were murdered on the same night by the same individual. They believe the timeline is as follows. Annette leaves Breckenridge around 5 p.m. to hitchhike back home and get ready for her shift at the bar. The killer picks her up, drives her 20 miles south, taking her down a small dead-end road where he sexually assaulted her. While she was putting her clothes back on, police believe she forgot to put on her other sock in her distress before she attempted escape. The killer then shot her in the back and left her body in the snow while driving off. Next, the killer returned to Breckenridge, where he found Bobby wandering around 8 p.m. looking for a ride home. He picks her up and takes her to a scenic overlook, where he tries to rape her, but she fought back and escaped his vehicle. As she did this, the other orange sock fell out of his car, and then the killer shot her twice and left her on the side of the highway, where she bled to death to be found by her husband hours later. Again, hitchhiking was not uncommon. This was a small town, and the recorded temperatures for that night were below 20 degrees Fahrenheit. So it makes sense that they thought that they would be safe. Unfortunately, as we know now,
you're not wrong.
Immediately, police did suspect Bobby's husband, Jeff. Before Annette's body was found, they still had tied the cases together since they knew that both the girls had disappeared in the same night. They questioned Jeff if he knew Annette, and at first Jeff denied it. However, he did recall that he did pick her up one day and give her his business card. He denied ever having involvement in either of their cases, though. When Annette was found, they did find Jeff's business card and the matching missing half to the orange sock that Bobby had, and they knew that they were on the right track. Police kept questioning Jeff, and he even took a polygraph test for them, but he did pass it. He claimed he had an alibi, but for some reason it took police 9 years to find the man that Jeff claimed to meet up with that night. And when they did question this man, his timeline did not match the one that Jeff had given.
What?
Yeah, I don't know.
9 years?
I don't know.
What?
But, yeah. Jeff did believe that Bobby was killed by someone she knew, since he'd already asked her if she wanted him to pick her up, but he claimed over and over that he didn't have anything to do with it. He stated once, quote, "Every time I go over, I think of Bobby. Sometimes it's a little less of a hurt. I'm just kind of saying hi to her on the way by. Hey, what are you doing today? Fishing with Grandpa?" Close quote. That kind of made me sad. He just talks to her every time he drives by where he found her body.
Oh my god.
Like, oof. So sad. So, police were also searching for the unidentified dark woman last seen with Annette on January 6th. She was described as a white female, 5'4 inches tall, and slender build. According to my research, she still, however, has not been found. For years after, here we go, here you go, boo-boo. Okay. For years after, the police assumed that the blood on Bobby's gloves and the tissues in her backpack were hers. You know.
It's not gonna be hers. Why would it be hers?
So in the 1990s, DNA testing determined that it was from a male. It also proved that the DNA was not Jeff. This, along with other alibis that eventually surfaced, officially cleared Jeff as a suspect in these murders.
Boom!
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 It's not Jeff. Now, unfortunately, the police were back to square one with their suspects. They did find a few serial killers that reportedly were in the Colorado area during this time, along with two men. One was a cab driver named Thomas Edward Luther, who beat and raped a hitchhiker after picking her up in Breckenridge in February of 1982, so only a month after these two girls had gone missing. Ooh. While in jail, Thomas had allegedly bragged about being responsible for the two girls' murders, and according to his girlfriend, he did not come home on the night of January 6th. He also lied to investigators and said that he was at work at the time. Another suspect they had was named Tracy Petroselli, I think, and he murdered his fiance in 1981 and went on a multi-state crime spree, you know, as one does.
Of course.
Cool. During this time, he stayed at Annette's workplace, the Holiday Inn in Fresno. However, neither suspect's DNA matched the evidence from the crime scene, and the serial killers police suspected did not connect to the DNA found. Luckily, in 2020, we caught a break. Metro Denver Crime Stoppers funded a genetic DNA test. If you don't know what that means, this is a relatively new thing that maybe you might not have heard about. So in recent years, since Ancestry DNA, 23andMe, and all those other genealogy websites have kicked off, they have also been using it to catch criminals. Did you know that when you consent to doing these tests, you're also consenting for your DNA to be entered into CODIS systems? This is how the Golden State Killer was recently caught, in case you didn't know about that. So with this technology, researchers were able to use the blood from the glove and tissues of Bobby's backpack to trace it through 12,000 members in a family tree to a 70-year-old man named Alan Lee Phillips, who was arrested and charged with the murders on February 24th, 2021. Thank Jesus. He was charged with kidnapping and assault with deadly weapon and is being held without bail. He's also suspected to be involved in other crimes throughout Colorado.
What the? Okay, that is insane.
Yep. Crazy.
So, like, did he submit?
No, so his, like, some, like, distant cousin or someone in his family tree submitted their DNA through one of these sites.
Uh-huh.
And they go through the, they take the blood from her shirt, they run it through, and they found 12,000 possible matches. And then they start going through, well, you know, let's find the highest percent. You know, you don't want the 1% chance.
Right.
So they find the highest percent, and then they start going through, like, them as suspects, and like, okay, who was at the place? Who could it have been? Like, where was this person? What were they doing? They cut out all those people until they get to like the one guy. And that's how they caught the Golden State Killer, just like last year, was through this. So y'all keep spitting in tubes, you're gonna catch all the killers.
I wanna do it, dude. I think it'd be cool. And I don't care.
I'm like, do it.
You can enter me in CODIS. Like, you ain't gonna find nothing.
I worked at a daycare. You worked at a daycare. Our fingerprints are already on the system.
Our fingerprints are on the system.
We have nothing else to lose.
I have nothing to hide. I'm just saying. Jordan's always like, don't say that. They're tapping in. I said, let them listen.
I'm like,
what are we talking about? Paw Patrol?
I know.
Like, seriously.
Like, with the vaccines. They're like, they're gonna track you. I'm like, where are they tracking me? Home to work? I'm sorry, they have a really boring day at work then, because I ain't doing nothing.
I know, seriously. They track us anyways with our socials. Like, come on, geniuses.
You have a really cool thing in your hand that's called a cell phone. They track you with that, too.
They're tracking you.
And guess what? You don't have to worry about being tracked unless you're doing something bad, so don't worry about it.
Exactly.
Anyway, that was a fun rant.
Yes, it was. Long story short, I want to do this.
Yes.
I want to find out my genealogy.
I don't even care about who my family is. I just want to help catch the people.
Or, no, dude, what would be the coolest thing is putting your genealogy into these websites and finding out, like, a distant cousin or something was a murderer.
I know, like, putting in
or
your...
Or something like that. How
putting
cool
in
that
your
be?
Spit. And
oh
then
my gosh.
2 weeks later, they're like, so Bobby was just arrested because they said that your spit led to him. And you're like, well, I shouldn't have done it.
Well... Well, it's a nice reminder that it isn't always the husband.
Yes, from both our stories. And also a nice reminder that you never know anyone. So for everyone that goes and gets those genealogy reports, don't be surprised when Aunt Betty gets arrested because your spit connected her to some murder.
With that, guys, don't forget our blog at twistedsisterscrime.com. You can find all of our sources and pictures from this week.
Other than that, see you all next week. Stay smart, stay safe, and stay twisted. And go spit.
Go